Very pleased to see you this morning. We have a number of families who have family with them, and we're thankful for that. We know that families often like to get together and come to church together on what is called Easter in the Christian tradition. But we're here to talk this morning for a few minutes about it being a lot more than a tradition. When we read in the New Testament, which is the document in its various parts that provides the guidance and direction for what Christianity is all about, we find no particular mention that early Christians, those first Christians, actually celebrated any special day of the year to honor the resurrection of Jesus. Instead, they followed the teachings of Jesus himself, that every first day of the week, they would take together a symbolic meal, a supper. We call it the Lord's Supper. Other parts of Christianity call it the Eucharist or Communion, which we also use that word. But it was a reminder to those early Christians that Jesus' body was offered on a cross and that His blood was shed. But it was only important to them because He rose from the dead. They were not remembering someone who was dead and gone, but they were remembering someone who died and rose again from the dead and was still alive in heaven at the right hand of God. So we want to talk about that for a few moments this morning. I've just recently returned from a trip to the northeastern United States. We spent 3 days in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is a very historic city in terms of the history of the United States and the birth of our nation. I think it was the original capital city. It's the place where Independence Hall is located, the Liberty Bell, the grave of many of the signers of the Declaration of Independence and Benjamin Franklin. Just everywhere you turn, there's little bits of history there for you to see. But just outside of Philadelphia, just a few miles, is a place called Valley Forge, also of great historical note. It's where the beleaguered troops of George Washington spent a very cold and miserable winter. Historians say that there hadn't been a winter that cold in 100 years in the Northeast. And yet here they were camped out on the banks of the Delaware River just a few miles from Philadelphia, trying to live in tents, ill-equipped. Most of them didn't have winter wear. Some of them didn't even have shoes. Just trying to keep hope alive and figure out and hope that George Washington could figure out some way to keep them from being annihilated by the British troops and, wonder of wonders, actually win independence for this nation that had just declared its independence. And we have that wonderful story of Washington crossing the Delaware. I don't think we know if he actually took a silver dollar or a quarter or any other piece of money and skipped it across the water before he crossed, but gathering together boats in the middle of the night, actually moving his troops across the river, the Delaware River that's there that runs through Philadelphia, and to catch the British troops by surprise the next day. Well, how do we know that happened? How do we know? I wasn't there, and neither were you. We don't even live in the time when our parents would have been alive, or our grandparents, to know that. And yet everywhere you look up there in that part of the country, here's monuments to this and memorials to that and national parks reminding us of something else that happened during that period of time in history. In point of fact, anything in history that happened before we lived and it happened before anyone we know lived is dependent on certain things for us to know whether it really happened or not. And yet even after we examine all the evidence that may exist for it, we have to admit there's a small amount of faith that is necessary. That step that has to be taken after you look at all the evidence, before you say in your mind you're firmly convinced that it happened. Christianity is based upon not only the existence and the life of a man named Jesus, who lived some 2,000 years ago in a small Jewish nation that was a part of the large Roman Empire. But it actually exists most of all because that man who lived died but was raised from the dead. The fact of the matter is that essentially every person who's ever lived on earth from the very beginning of mankind until today has died or will, but he's the only one who has risen from the dead, never to die again. And while some will say that's too fantastic to believe, no matter what the evidence is it? I was blessed. I forget the year. Was it 1969, Narita, when I'm sitting there watching on a black and white TV when two men step out of a lunar module onto the surface of the moon? Is there enough evidence to believe that really happened? Some of you aren't old enough to have seen that yourself. There are some folks alive who are old enough to have seen that and still don't believe it really happened. They believe it was some kind of government trick, some kind of deception to justify an inordinately gross amount of money that was spent by our government. And they don't believe that men have actually walked on the moon. It's up to each of us to look at the evidence and make a decision and take a step of faith. Did they or didn't they? Now, truth to tell, there's some matters of historical fact that even if you believe they're true, they're not of great enough importance to make that much difference. To believe that Washington crossed the Delaware with his army is a matter of historical fact. Believing it then helps us understand a lot of what happened after that in that war that led to our independence. To ask the question, did George Washington have blue eyes, is a matter of historical inquiry. But truth to tell, what difference would it make? He did have blue eyes, by the way. He was also 6'2", weighed between 175 and 200 pounds, which means he was thinner than me. But, you know, those historical facts don't necessarily make a difference. And so, for us, when we talk about the resurrection of Jesus, we really are asking two things. Number one, is it true? Did it really happen? But number two, does it matter? Does it matter? There are millions, untold millions of people in our world today who believe fervently with all their heart that it happened and that it makes a difference. There are millions of others who believe that it's only a sort of religious fairy tale, a legend, a myth, wishful thinking perhaps, by those who are true believers. And then there are still millions of others who don't have an opinion at all on the subject and have no reason to think they should. Doesn't make any difference to them one way or the other. So let's see if we can talk about that for a few moments together this morning. Is it true? Is it a matter of history? Are simply a matter of wishful thinking or legend or myth. In my library, I have the books written by a number of different men who formerly were skeptics, even atheists, unbelievers, many of them not just unbelievers in Christianity, but even unbelievers that there even a God existed. And it's interesting how many of them ended up, I'm not saying every atheist this happens, we know it's not true, but for these men who started out as atheists and agnostics and unbelievers and yet had a scholarly bent who said, we're going to set about to prove that this fundamental tenet or faith of the Christian religion is untrue, how many of them ended up as Christians? Just some in the last 100 years, men like C.S. Lewis, probably one of the most famous English authors and philosophers of the 20th century, a very popular and famous man who's went all over the world speaking on at universities about the truth of Christianity, Josh McDowell. More recently, a man who sort of stepped in, even though he didn't follow in the steps of McDowell, but is doing the same thing now, a man named Lee Strobel, who had a law degree and was a reporter for years and years at the Chicago Sun-Times, Chicago Tribune, covering legal matters and court cases in Chicago, and who was not a believer and thought that his background in the law and in evidence and his ability as a reporter would help him prove once and for all that the resurrection did not and could not happen. He now spends full time trying to convince other people it did. And name after name after name we could give. This lets us know that at least somebody has found some kind of evidence of a historical nature that was convincing to them. What makes something acceptable to us is true from a historical standpoint? How do we know whether it's Washington crossing the Delaware or Abraham Lincoln giving the Gettysburg Address, Columbus discovering America, Julius Caesar being assassinated, or any other event in history? How do we know if it happened or not? Well, there has to be some kind of, first of all, preferable by far, eyewitness testimony. Some kind of records that exist of someone who was there, who wrote down a record in length or in brief of what happened. Preferably multiple eyewitnesses. And not only eyewitness testimony, but it really needs to be eyewitness testimony. Not someone who's writing 100 years later or 1,000 years later that it happened, but someone who lived when it happened, writing it down. In addition to that, it's great if we can find some kind of corroborating evidence. It might be in the nature of monuments. It might be in the nature of archaeological remains. It might be even in the nature of some celebration that people started practicing after that. This morning in our Bible class, we were reading in the book of Esther. The book of Esther is a story of a young Jewish woman who ends up being queen in the Persian Empire under King Xerxes. Because of a plot that was hatched among one of his noblemen to kill the Jewish people in the Persian Empire, and Esther being able to step in and help thwart that, the Jewish people from then until now have celebrated something called the Feast of Purim. That serves as evidence for historians that the event really happened, because they can trace the practice of the Feast of Purim right back to that period of time. People don't just suddenly start celebrating something as having happened in the very generation when it supposedly happened, if it didn't. Now, of course, not everything that happens in history ends up having a celebration about it. We still don't celebrate men walking on the moon. I even have to question, was it 1969? And I certainly couldn't tell you what month and day. But that doesn't keep it from being historically true. So we want to have eyewitnesses, at least one, and preferably many. We want to have some kind of corroborating evidence. On top of that, we want to see if within a reasonable period of time did anything rise up that would counter that would contradict that. And that's true. You know, I'm just speaking, generally speaking, of how historians work. The amazing thing is, historians will accept pretty tiny bits of information as history. Let me give you an example. You ever heard of Sparta and Troy and the war on Troy and the Trojan horse? You may not remember too much about that from history, if it was even covered in your history class on world history. But the story of two city-states in the ancient world that go to war over the wife of a king that is wooed and won by another king, and she's taken away and she goes and is in this other city-state called Troy, and the Spartans are incensed by that. They wage war on the Trojans, and after a long war of something like 10 or 12 years, they're unable to defeat the people of Troy. And yet there's this story that at the very end, they build a huge statue of a horse. And when the Trojans come out the next morning, here's this huge statue of a horse outside their city gates, but no Spartans anywhere. And the ships are gone, and the Trojans believe, we won. And they've left even a gift for us. And so they take the horse and wheel it into their city, and they celebrate all day and get drunk and have parties and all that kind of thing. And while everybody's trying to sleep it off during the night, a door opens in the horse, and Spartan soldiers come dropping out. Meanwhile, during the night, the Spartan ships have come back ashore again. And the gates are opened, and the Spartan army pours into the city, and the city of Troy is destroyed. Recently been a movie, only very loosely based on this story. And numerous other books written, poems and other things, even in modern times about it. But what's the evidence for that? Did you realize that the whole story of Troy and the Trojan horse is based almost entirely upon two documents two ancient writings called the Iliad and the Odyssey, written by someone named Homer. So stick with me for a moment. Number one, scholars aren't even sure Homer was a real person. Number two, the events of this war apparently took place around 1200 B.C. The Iliad and the Odyssey, these two documents, were apparently originally written around 900 B.C., 300 years later. The earliest copy we have of even a part of either one of those documents is from 400 B.C. I dare you to find the scholar today who does not believe that the war against Troy and the Trojan horse is not true. What's their evidence for it? Two documents originally written 300 years after the events, and the earliest copies of we have are some 800 years after the events. And yet scholars look at these documents and says, there's enough evidence here for us to believe that war actually took place, and there was at least something like a Trojan horse that really was a part of it. Now, in the 1870s, ruins of a city were actually found in the very place where the ancient story said Troy was. And scholars now almost universally have accepted the ruins of this place as being ancient Troy, though they haven't found the remains of a horse, wooden or otherwise. What I'm telling you is that from a historical standpoint, it doesn't take a lot of evidence for scholars to believe something. It's not because they're gullible are easily misled. It's rather they realize that it's the nature of history that over time evidence disappears. And with time you have less and less of it. And so you take what you've got. You can't say, I would believe this if I only had more evidence. Well, you don't have more evidence. You just have to make your decision based on what you have. So what do we have for the evidence for the resurrection? Eyewitnesses. We have, in what has now been collected over the centuries into our Bibles, we have the eyewitness testimony of numerous people. The first four Gospels, the first four books in our New Testament called the Gospels, three of them are written by men who claim to be eyewitnesses to what happened. Matthew, Mark, and John. The fourth Gospel, written by Luke, is written by men who lived in the same time and who even traveled in the same place where these events happened, and who claimed to know the people who saw it happen. And he even says at the beginning of his book that he writes his book having interviewed and talked with these people and put this information together. And on top of the four Gospels, we have the writings of Paul, who numerous times talks about the resurrection of Jesus, and he was one of the ones who either participated or at least gave his consent to the killing of Jesus because he wasn't a believer. And yet later he becomes a Christian and an ardent promoter of the Christian faith, believing in the resurrection. We have his writings, we have the writings of Peter, we have the writings of James, we have the writings of Jude, all in our New Testament. So we have multiple eyewitnesses. And they don't just make an incidental mention of the resurrection. They devote extensive amount of space, especially the gospel writers, in telling us what happened, when, where, how, and who was there. So they were providing all sorts of evidence so at least the first few generations of people could have practically an overwhelming amount of evidence that really happened. But now with time, some of that evidence has disappeared. We know that. But what we have is practically overwhelming from a historical standpoint. And not only do we have the written records of eyewitnesses, but we have corroborating evidence. It's very interesting that when you get outside of the pages of the New Testament into other early Christian writings, almost the very first thing in those early Christian writings you encounter is Christians celebrating something they were calling communion or the supper every Sunday. Within the very next generation, at least, if you don't even listen to the eyewitness testimony who says they begin it within just a few weeks, but even if you look at the outside testimony beyond the New Testament, you find within at least one generation Christians everywhere that we had any record of were celebrating something every Sunday called the supper, in which they were taking bread and reminding themselves that Jesus' body was given on a cross, and they were taking wine or grape juice and drinking that, and it was reminding them that His blood was spilled on that cross. And they keep reminding each other week after week that we're eating this and we're drinking this and we're going to keep on doing it until He comes again. Which says He's risen from the dead, He's gone back to heaven, and we're waiting for Him to come back for us. That's what scholars call, from a historical standpoint, corroborating evidence. The fact the church itself exists and has existed from within weeks after His supposed resurrection is also corroborating evidence. An organization that came into existence, a fervent group of believers who, in spite of persecution and suffering and being outlawed in the very empire in which they lived, the Roman Empire, they not only continued to exist, but they were able to convince their fellow countrymen that it was true, and so gradually the group kept getting bigger and bigger. And so after about 300 years, it's estimated that somewhere between 10 and 20% of the Roman Empire was Christian, and it wasn't even legal to be Christian. From a historian's standpoint, that's evidence. So is it true? By any measure that a historian would use to determine anything as being true, it's true. Now, yes, there still has to be that step of faith that says, I realize that there might be some very remote possibility that this is some kind of an elaborate misunderstanding, hoax, conspiracy, or something. Even though there's no evidence of any of that. Even though people like to write movies and books and so forth that claim such. Invariably, they have to say in those conspiracy theory books and movies, first of all, we want you to ignore the evidence, and now let us tell you how it really happened. Because they know they don't have any evidence to support what they're saying. So yes, it's true. But does it matter? Does it make any difference? If Jesus were to have said, and we have the historical records of what He said, at least some of what He said, if Jesus were to have said, the ultimate proof of who I am and what I can do is going to be the fact I'm going to rise from the dead, would that make any difference? That is what He said. He said, this, for those who can't believe that I'm from God and that I have come to save mankind from their sins and make them right with God, for those who can't believe that because of my miracles, who can't believe that because of seeing me for what I am, can't believe that for what I teach, can't believe that because I fulfill the prophecies from the Old Testament, He says, there's only one sign for them. And that's what's going to happen on the third day. After my death. He said, that's the final proof I will offer. And what happened on the third day after His death? What happened? On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. But they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. And when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. And while they were wondering about this, suddenly two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them. And in their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground. But the men said to them, why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here. He has risen. Remember how He told you? Jesus says this was the ultimate proof of who He was. Now people may still choose to not believe that He was from God. But then you do explain the resurrection. Because He said it was the ultimate proof of who He was. He also said that it's the ultimate proof of what He came to do. Again, if someone can predict ahead of time, not just their death, I can predict my death. I'm going to die one day. That wasn't very difficult. Who couldn't say that? But can I predict that I'll rise again 3 days later? I might make that claim. There have been a few people in history who have. But so far, none of them have. Without trying to pick on any particular religious groups, but there is a religious group that is stronger in the northeast United States than down here, but it even exists down here. I've seen some of their meeting places. Their founder was a woman. Her name was Mary Baker Glover Patterson Eddy. And she claimed before she died that she would rise from the dead. She died slightly before 1900. Her grave is still outside their number one church building up in Boston. It's still venerated and honored by believers who still wait for her to rise from the dead. She hadn't done it so far. There was a man in the 50s that lived in New York City that had created a little cult-like following, only very remotely akin to Christianity in any form or shape. He called himself Father Divine. And he told his followers when he got sick that they didn't need to worry that he was going to die, but he would rise from the dead. He didn't. And he hasn't. And there's no one even today who is even a part of that religious group anymore. It no longer exists. For one of the founding tenets of it ultimately was that their founder was going to rise from the dead, and he hasn't. So a few have made that kind of claim. That means you need to put in serious question anything else that person claims. If they can't get it right on that, did they get it right on anything? Jesus not only predicted his death, but also his resurrection. He predicted all sorts of other things. They've all happened as well. And he said, I have come to give my life a ransom for many. I am the Lamb of God. I am the sacrifice that God has sent to pay for the sins of mankind. Does it matter? If he really rose from the dead, he says it matters. Now, you may not choose to believe that. Many don't. But certainly, if you do believe that, and I do with all my heart, I've got good reason to. For I've got it from the mouth of the one who gave the ultimate proof that he was telling the truth. Jesus says that death is not the end. In fact, he said, I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who lives and believes in me, even though he dies, he will live. I haven't experienced that yet. I'm still alive for the first time. I haven't died. He tells me that I can know that even after my death, physically, that life will go on. Can I believe that? I do. Why? Because he rose from the dead. He provided the evidence that lets me know I can trust him above others. Oh yes, there's others who, scientists, philosophers, religious leaders and others who will tell us all sorts of other things about death and what's beyond, if anything. But I'm going to trust the one who's been there and came back. You know, if Christopher Columbus had sailed to the West Indies, and he thought he was sailing to the East Indies, that's why they're called the Indies. He got to the wrong ones. If he had sailed to the West Indies and never came back to Portugal and Spain, how would anybody know? How would anybody know? But he did come back. He brought with him native peoples from the West Indies, along with spices and other things they had taken there, to provide the evidence that he had been and came back. And that created a huge, eventually, exodus from Europe to the Americas because of that evidence. Jesus went over on the other side of death and came back and provided the evidence by being here, by over 500 people seeing him alive, by eyewitnesses writing down the records of what happened and what they saw and what he said. So we can know that death is not the end, but there's life beyond that. But he also said, unless you believe that I am him, you will die in your sins. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man can come unto the Father in any other way except by me. Are there many ways to God? Listen to a philosopher. Listen to a religious professor at a college. Listen to many religious leaders and other religious groups, and they'll say, yeah, there's many ways to God. The only one who went over on the other side of death and came back says no. There's only one. Only one way. Who are you going to believe? The resurrection says not only that he was who he said he was and that he came and died for the sins of the world and that there's life after death, but also says he is the only way you can be right with God. No other way. Look at the evidence. Decide if you want to take that step of faith and do what comes next. Many have chosen to do that. Many have chosen not to. Many have never even given it a thought and don't realize that's even a choice for them. The Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, out of the passage it was read for us by Don, he has a whole chapter in this letter he writes to the Christians in Corinth about the resurrection. Already, by the time he's writing that, there were some in Corinth who were saying resurrection is impossible. It's not that they were examining the evidence. They were just, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, they said, well, resurrection is impossible. Therefore, no matter how much evidence you give me, it can't have happened. Is that how you make decisions? I can say, Well, I've got money in my bank account. I don't care what you say. I don't care about all those statements that keep coming in the mail and all those overdraft notices from the bank. I've got money in the bank. I'm going to keep spending it. You're just going to have a philosophical preconceived idea that something is true or not true, or are you going to look at the evidence? The resurrection, from a historical standpoint, happened by every measure and standard we can use. But what are you going to do about it? Just treat it the same way you now treat probably George Washington crossing the Delaware, saying, interesting historical fact, but it doesn't make any difference to me? Or are you going to follow through on the consequences? Mark has an invitation song for us. It just invites us to think about these things and decide what we're going to do about them. On this day, when most of Christianity, at least Western Christianity, celebrates the resurrection of Jesus, not just in the weekly supper, but in this annual thing they call Easter, maybe it's time for you to think about what you're going to do. And if we can help you with that in any way, give you that opportunity now to come and let us know while we stand up and sing.